Today, Background Briefing has a laugh, a very old laugh. In fact, we hear some of the humour from the oldest known joke book in the world. It's called The Philo Gallows, The Laughter Lover, and was translated and examined by Mary Beard, who's Professor of Classics at Cambridge University.
An egghead met a friend and said, "I heard that you were dead." The man replied, "No, you can see I'm alive." "But," replied the egghead, "the person who told me was much more reliable than you." Or number 29, they're a pair of twins and one of them died. An egghead met the survivor and asked, "Was it you who died or your brother?" And so on.
Mary Beard will be setting many of these old Roman jokes against a backdrop of historical analysis of what we understand about the role of humour and how today's humour has developed. Hello, this is Kirsten Garrett and you're listening to ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. Here's Mary Beard talking at Newcastle University in the UK about laughter in the classical world.
I'm going to stand here and it's got a joke on this pedestal. It says, "Do not move. Danger of electric shock." So if I disappear, I'm going to try and convince you that ancient jokes are not bad. Right. And I'm going to start with one. This is testing the water, because if you don't find this one funny, we've got problems. Three men, a scholasticos, and I'll translate that as an egghead for now, but you could say kind of absent-minded professor. Three men, a scholasticos, a bald man and a barber, were on a trip together and camping out in a remote spot. They agreed that they would each stay awake for 4 hours to watch over the luggage. The lot fell to the barber to take the first watch, and wanting to have some fun, because it was jolly boring, he decided to shave the head of the scholasticos, the egghead, as he slept. And then he woke him up when his own four-hour shift was finished for him to take his turn. Rubbing his head as he came to, the scholasticos found himself bald. "What an idiot that barber is," he said. "He's made a terrible mistake. He's woken up baldy instead of me." Phew. That's a story, Joke 56, as it's now numbered, in a collection of over 260 ancient jokes in Greek that go under the title The Philogelos, or The Laughter Lover. The one that I've just read is a little bit longer than most of them, but it's not untypical of the collection as a whole. Try number 112. An Abderite, that's a man from the Greek city of Abdera in Thrace, was trying to hang himself. And when the rope snapped, he banged his head. So he got a plaster from the doctor and put it on the wound, went back and hung himself. Or the number 173. A man from Kaimi, which is a city on the coast of modern Turkey, was selling some honey. Someone came and tasted it and said it was really very good. "It sure is," said the seller. "I wouldn't be getting rid of it if that mouse hadn't fallen into it." I think it's a very kind of nice mirror, sort of reverse story of the waiter, waiter, there's a fly in my soup story. Now, I have to confess, before you get your hopes too high, I have to confess that this collection of ancient jokes isn't typical of the jokes that survive from the ancient world. This is a rather untypical collection, but it's untypical for various reasons. Most of the recorded jokes, if we should call them that, from Rome are witty sayings, riposts, kind of banter, attributed to famous people or about famous people. And when they're collected together, as they sometimes are, it's usually to illustrate a point, like how witty our ancestors were. Load of jokes. In fact, the orator Cicero, despite his rather pompous reputation, is actually said to be the funniest Roman of them all. The collection that I'm going to be talking about today is, by contrast, characterised almost entirely by anonymous jokes or type jokes. the egghead jokes, the Abderite jokes, the eunuch jokes, the man with bad breath jokes, the cowardly boxer jokes. Right? They're also independent, uncontextualised stories, and they follow a very similar generic formula. Almost every single one of the 260 or so starts with the name of the type character concerned. There was a man from Kaimi who, there was a man with bad breath who, there was a fortune teller who, and so on. And what's more, this book is just a list of jokes. It isn't any more than that. There's no particular point apparently being made, and there's no narrative connection. It doesn't even say, and here's another joke about the same thing. It's just one after the other. Now, I want to spend a bit of time thinking about what this one and only joke collection of this type to survive from antiquity is. What is it? But it's also going to act as a thread to take us into the question of the subjects and themes of ancient laughter and joking. What is it that the Romans laughed at? And I'm going to end up by thinking how far our own laughter overlaps with the Romans. And one question has to be, even when we find the same thing funny, to what extent are we laughing at the same things? We can find the joke funny and laugh at it like the Romans did, but are we laughing at the same thing about it? And I'll give you just one example of that, which is a kind of prequel for the end, because this is number 12 in the Philogillos. An egghead was going travelling, and a friend said to him, "Could you buy me 2 15-year-old slave boys?" "Yes," he said, "and if I can't find you 2 15-year-olds, I'll buy you 1 30-year-old. I'm quite interested in what we are laughing at when we laugh at that joke. Because when I told it to my graduate students in a class, unlike me, they assumed it was a joke about sex. They thought that, look, this is a joke about paedophilia. I want 2 pretty little slave boys, complete misunderstanding, and he's going to bring a 30-year-old, and that wouldn't do as well. But I wasn't sure when I listened to them laugh. They were absolutely convinced it was about sex. I wasn't sure it was that for the Romans, or for me, for that matter. I'd always assumed that it was much more about the kind of strange conventions of numbering and how those conventions match up to objects in the real world. You know, that it was actually showing you that there was something very odd about the way 15 went into 30, because actually you couldn't put 2 15s together and make 30 in the same kind of way. Or maybe I thought it's always had 2 levels. Maybe people have always laughed at different things about it. Now, I should also say that this is part, what I'm going to give you today, is part of a bigger study on Roman laughters. Because, of course, most laughter in the world, ancient world or modern world, is not produced by jokes as such at all. And in the big picture, what I'm attempting to do is actually to go beyond joking to thinking about what you might call a map of laughter in Roman culture. Where does laughter happen? Where shouldn't you laugh in Rome? What makes you laugh? What boundaries does it transgress? What does it signal? And interestingly, Latin has a very limited range of vocabulary for laughing. Pretty much all the words for laughing are compounds of the same word, rideo. But it has a vast range of words for the things that prompt you to laugh: wit, joke, humour, cleverness, etc. So what's the significance in that? And what's the significance in, I think, the curious fact that the smile seems not to exist in Rome? I mean, I'm sure Romans did move their lips into something we would call a smile, but our own kind of stress on smiling is an absolutely crucial signifier in cultural interaction. Seems to be not there in Rome. All you can smile is just a little laugh. And the reason I've chosen it, and I think I kind of want to stress this before we get on to the sort of pleasant minutiae of the jokes of the Philogillos. The reason I've chosen it is that laughter as a subject does seem to me to push us absolutely right up to the very edge of our ability to understand or even describe ancient culture, or really any other historical culture for that matter. What is it to find something funny in another culture? is about as far as you can go in actually understanding it. So let's think first about the basic character of this joke collection.
There are about 260 jokes in the Philogelos, which is written in Greek. The printed edition was put together in the 4th century from several manuscripts of ancient texts. We don't know much about the people who collected the material, but there is a link to an article by Professor Mary Beard on the Background Briefing website, which has some further explanations. This is ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. And now again, Professor Mary Beard.
Joke 62, for example, makes a clear reference to the games that celebrated the millennium, the 1000th anniversary of Rome in 248 AD. It's another of those Scholasticus jokes. An egghead meets an athlete who's crying after losing in his event at the millennial games. "Cheer up," says the egghead, "I bet you'll win at the next millennial games." As for geography, the jokes themselves are in Greek, and there are plenty of references to cities in the Eastern Mediterranean, Greek city of Abdera, Chyme, Sidon. But there are also plenty of Western things, or more strictly Roman references. There's mention of the River Rhine, there's a vintage of Italian wine, and when they talk about money, they use Roman currency. And occasionally, when a proper name is mentioned, sometimes it's Greek, sometimes it's Roman. So it's a kind of pan-Mediterranean Roman imperial book. More interesting, though, there is actually much greater overlap between the jokes in the collection and the personalised jokes and anecdotes that other ancient writers record tied to individuals. Take this story, told by the 1st century AD historian Velleius Paterculus, about Mummius, the Roman conqueror of Corinth in 146 BC. Now, a lot of Greek masterpieces of art came into Roman hands as booty on that occasion when the Romans destroyed utterly the rich Greek city of Corinth. This is what Velleius has to say. Mummius, the conqueror, was so unsophisticated that after the capture of Corinth, when he was contracting for the paintings and statues of the most famous masters to be transported back to Italy, he gave orders that the contractors should be told that if they lost them, they'd have to replace them with new ones. A funny story, in other words, about Mummius, the Philistine, who thinks that new for old insurance policies, you know, work with antiquities. Now listen to joke number 78 from the Philogelos. An egghead was taking some very ancient paintings from Corinth. As he put them on board the ships, he said to their captains, "If you lose these, I shall demand new ones in their place." That is, in other words, I think, the same joke, and it looks as if an old story about Mummius has been anonymised and reprocessed into an egghead joke. Another striking example is number 193, which is a bad-tempered man joke. A bad-tempered man was being visited by someone. "I'm not at home," he answered to the knock on the door. But the other person laughed and said, "You're lying. I recognise your voice." "Oh, damn. If my slave had shouted, you'd have believed him. Do I seem to you less trustworthy than him?" Now, that very joke is, in fact, a clever bon mot quoted with approval by Cicero in his handbook on oratory, the De Oratore. In that version, the bad-tempered man, who's interestingly the very witty hero of Cicero's version, is Scipio Nasica, and the persistent visitor who wants to see him is Ennius, the poet. So if we take the printed text as we now have it, the first half, jokes 1 to 103, are all what I've been calling scholastikos, egghead, absent-minded professor-type jokes. The scholastikos is someone who, you'll see, is foolish by reason of being too learned, who applies faultless logic to reach completely stupid conclusions, and is the repeated victim of what philosophers would call false analogy syndrome. Here's an example. This is a Scholasticos, who's also a doctor. An egghead doctor was seeing a patient. "Doctor," the patient said, "whenever I get up in the morning, I feel dizzy for half an hour, and then I'm all right." "Get up half an hour later, then." Heard that one before, right? Now, those egghead jokes are followed by smaller clusters of other type jokes, as I've suggested. Jokes about the people from Abdera, who are just as stupid as the eggheads. Jokes about people from Sidon, about sharp talkers, people from Chyme, bad-tempered, fortune-tellers, men with bad breath, eunuchs, and so forth. Subtle distinctions or not, the range of characters and subject matters, as well as the sometimes taken-for-granted background setting to the individual stories, raises all kinds of questions and surprises. Try thinking about what this little joke tells you about ancient culture. It's quite unsettling. A man from Abdera saw a runner who'd been crucified. "By the gods," he said, "he does not so much run anymore as fly." I see the joke, but crucifixion jokes? Much of the material, most of the material, I have to say, is less extreme than that. But it's revealing, nonetheless, the background of these jokes, I think, take us into ancient culture and ancient culture's problems. To put it in terms of modern studies of laughter, the joking can pretty plausibly be seen, slightly ponderously, as a means of debating, negotiating cultural difficulties or uncertainties, as many joking cultures can be. I think we're all more or less familiar with the Freudian version of this, in which laughter is seen as the sign of the unlocking of repression. Hence the jokes that often get told about undertakers in many cultures, and hence perhaps the crucifixion quip that I've just quoted. And obviously a Freudian view of jokes lies in the background of almost every modern study of them. But I myself have been particularly helped, not so much by Freud, but by a neat little book by the philosopher Simon Critchley discussing joking and laughter, which tends to play down the Freudian psychoanalytic aspect of laughter. Instead, Critchley suggests that laughter and joking functions partly as a distancing device, which enables us to become, as it were, domestic anthropologists, anthropologists of our own world. It invites us, he suggests, the joke invites us to become spectators on our own lives in seeing the funny side of our own world. By pulling us out of common sense, the joke actually reveals to us what common sense is and what kind of misrepresentations, shortcuts, occlusions, common sense rests on. The joke enables us to take a fresh look at things we normally take for granted and to find them funny. Now, you can see that in a very simple way in a number of jokes in the Philagelos. Take, for example, the series of jokes in which one of our categories, whether that's a Scholasticos, an Abderite, or whoever, is represented in an encounter with a doctor. An egghead, seeing his usual doctor coming his way, took care to avoid being seen. When a friend asked why, he said, "Because it's so long since I've been ill that I'm ashamed to meet him." Which is actually, I think, quite a nice reflection on the really paradoxical nature of the relationship between patient and physician, and the dependence of the physician on our own misfortune. And I think that's a kind of dependence and a paradox about how you get on with your doctor and that you don't see him when you're well, that we kind of don't see, that most cultures don't look at in day-to-day life. And I think that's what those jokes, in a sense, are nicely pointing to. There's something odd about a relationship you have with someone who only works on you and with you when you're not well.
You're listening to Cambridge Classics Professor Mary Beard on laughter in the ancient world. Her lecture is based on the oldest joke book in the world, the Philagelos. Professor Beard was speaking at the University of Newcastle in the UK. I'm Kirsten Garrett, and this is ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. Professor Mary Beard.
But what about the big themes in this collection? There are, I have to say, plenty to choose from, and sadly I'm not going to have a chance to deal with eunuchs. There's plenty on eunuchs. There's plenty on hernias. I'm not going to look at hernias. There's even a couple of cases of eunuchs with hernias. I'm also going to leave out. I'm not going to talk about awkward family relations, though I should say there's not much. There's a bit, but not much about sex as such in the Filagellos as a whole, which may reflect back to its origin, may be something to do with what gets left out in the process of copying. One theme is absolutely unmissable, however. With the sections on jokes about Abderites, jokes about Sidonians, jokes about the people of Chyme, we've got what we might call the ethnic joke. Now, overall, there's a good deal of intersection between Roman laughter and Roman geography. Roman writers had a mental map of those cities and those nations that were particularly good at cracking jokes or were generally held to be witty. The Athenians almost always hold first place in that, but close second come the Sicilians, they're very funny, and also the Rhodians. The Romans also had a mental map of how some cities and nations laughed differently, whether a lot, not at all, or at different things. One whole speech of the late 1st century CE orator Dio Chrysostom is addressed to the people of Alexandria, criticising them for, among other things, laughing too much. And Tacitus, sharply, though slightly enigmatically, I must say, remarks in his Historical Anthropology of Germany that no one among the Germans laughs at vice, which seems to reflect a combination of factors, that the Germans don't have Roman vices to laugh at, and what the Germans do to vice is a lot more devastatingly nasty than just laugh at it. Not quite sure. But there is a kind of sense that the world laughs differently. But there's also the laughter that laughs at other nations or cities, rather like our jokes about, depending on where we are, Poles, Irish, French jokes about Belgians, and so on. We have, in fact, one extraordinary rare glimpse of Roman customs themselves being the butt of ethnocentric laughter. Among various versions of the outbreak of war between Rome and the city of Tarentum at the beginning of the 3rd century BC, there are repeated stories of the Romans being laughed at by the Tarentines. In the account of Dionysius of Halicarnassus, it appears to be the terribly bad Greek of the ambassador Postumius which makes the Tarentines laugh. In Dio's later account, which is admittedly written centuries after the incident itself, it is the Romans' togas that look so silly and cause the Tarentines to crack up. Now, it's a wonderful glimpse, I think, for us of an ancient perspective through which, from the outside, the Roman toga, even in the ancient world, looked a really silly piece of clothing. And I think we often think it's only us, you know, it's only us that thinks that the toga's a sheet, you know, and you dress Frankie Howard up in it and laugh at it. Actually, just this faint glimpse that there are other people in antiquity who are saying, what an idiotic piece of clothing. But more often, of course, we're not looking at how people found the Romans funny. We're thinking about what peoples the Romans found amusing.
Professor Beard gives an example of one joke about how stupid the people of Chyme were.
The people of Chyme were expecting the arrival of a distinguished ally. They wanted to honour him with a bath of clean water. But as they only had one bathhouse, they filled the bath with clean hot water and put a grill across the middle to keep hearth clean for their expected guest.
In the full speech, Professor Beard gives many examples of this kind of humour poking fun at certain ethnic traits. The Abderites, we're told, were constantly berated for being chaotic.
In his letters, for example, Cicero uses the shorthand, "It's all Abdera here," to refer to the completely topsy-turvy mess in Rome in the middle of elections. But more important, Abdera was the hometown of Democritus, the so-called laughing philosopher. Democritus, in real life, was a 5th century BC Greek philosopher and natural scientist. But in the Roman period, and it really was only, I think, in the Roman period, he became additionally and definitively characterised as the philosopher who'd always been laughing. In that role, he is one of the subjects of what is, in effect, an extraordinary Roman epistolary novel that has come down to us among the so-called letters of the early Greek doctor Hippocrates, though the letters are fake, of course, in the sense that they were written centuries after the death of the real doctor Hippocrates and centuries after the death of the real Democritus. The letters purport to document an incident in the history of Abdera. For the Abderites, so it's explained, had become increasingly concerned about the sanity of their famous philosopher Democritus, for the simple reason that he laughed the whole time and at the most embarrassingly inappropriate things. Someone marries, a man engages in trade, a man goes into politics, takes an office, goes on an embassy, votes, falls ill, is wounded, dies. He laughs at every one of them. So the Abderites write in exasperation to Hippocrates, asking the doctor to come to Abdera to try to cure the philosopher, whose laughing, the Abderites imagine, must be the result of some terrible illness. Hippocrates comes, but as we learn from his letters, he discovers that Democritus is not mad at all. The philosopher's laughter is, of course, an appropriate reaction to the folly of human existence. Democritus is proved to be right to laugh for everything. But en route to that conclusion, which takes Hippocrates some time to reach, there's plenty of opportunity for various parties in this correspondence, the Abderites and others, to discuss their view of what laughter is for. And as such, it amounts, I think, to one of the most extended treatises on the subject of laughter to survive from the ancient world. But for now, the point I want to underline is the fact that Abdera clearly has a special place in the map of Roman laughter, and it's one that remains reflected in this joke collection.
Professor Mary Beard is a classics professor at Cambridge University, and she's also classics editor for the Times Literary Supplement. In this talk at Newcastle University in the UK, Mary Beard says that so far she's looked at only one dimension of these ancient jokes.
Can we move up or perhaps down a notch now to think about the deeper structure of the jokes, to ask if there are bigger and more general questions at play? The answer, I'm sure, is yes, and there are various directions you could take it. But I want to spend just a little time instead on the related question of personal identity and what authenticates an individual. Now, we've already seen several examples of identity questions in the jokes that I've quoted. I started the lecture with the joke about the egghead, whose hair was shaved off and woke up to confuse himself with the bald man. Then there was the joke about the bad-tempered man, who answered the knock with the reply, "I'm not at home," and fell to reflect that his slave would have been treated as a more trustworthy guide to his own presence or absence than he himself. But there are many others which play on that problem of what, how do you show and prove identity? Number 22, for example. An egghead met a friend and said, "I heard that you were dead." The man replied, "No, you can see I'm alive." "But," replied the egghead, "the person who told me was much more reliable than you." Or number 29, they're a pair of twins and one of them died. An egghead met the survivor and asked, "Was it you who died or your brother?" And so on. Quite good, those. Now, obviously, in some ways, those jokes point us in the direction of the ancient ego and its definition. But I think they ask us even more to reflect on the cultural and social parameters of identity and where the authority to authenticate identity and individuality lie. I think the question who was who in the Roman world was a much, much trickier question than it is or ever could be for us. And crucially, the institutions of personal slavery significantly nuanced the level of authority with which anyone could speak on behalf of anyone else or their identity. That joke about the master's authority to speak on his own behalf being somehow less than his slave's authority to authenticate him reminds me, interestingly, of a well-known anecdote told by Dio about the ingenious cruelty of the emperor Domitian. You'll see how this is taking us into, I think, uncharted realms about ancient slavery. One evening, Domitian is supposed to have invited some leading men of the city of Rome to dinner. When they arrived, they discovered a strange scene. Everything was black. The dining couches were in the form of tombstones. The food was funeral food. And the emperor himself droned on the whole time about death and dying. The guys spent the evening in terror, thinking that they knew all too well where this was going to end. But there was a surprise in store. When eventually they got home and there was the expected knock on the door, it wasn't an assassin at all. It was a man bearing piles of gifts from the emperor. Now, I'm sure you can guess how this story is normally used to illustrate the kind of tense relations between the Roman elite and the Roman emperor. But one significant aspect of it is often passed over without mention. That is, one of the cruelties of the emperor Domitian that Dio stresses is the fact that when at the end of the meal the emperor sends his guests home, he mixes up their slaves. He sends them home with other people's slaves, dispatching them with someone else's minder. And that seems to me to be another interesting link, an interesting hint of how the elite Roman's identity is bound up with the identity and presence and authority of his slave. You see, in one case, that reflected in a joking relationship, in the joke from the Philagelos, in the form of an anecdote of imperial cruelty in Dio, still pointing in the same direction, that slavery is an important aspect of how you think you are as a Roman elite male.
This is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. Professor Mary Beard is talking about the Philagelos, the world's oldest joke book.
The final reflection I want to leave you with, though, is a simultaneously simple and complicated one. Forget for a minute the issues about domestic anthropology or identity politics or whatever. The most striking thing about the picture of the Philagelos I've given is how understandable the jokes are. There are a few, I admit, that simply don't resonate. I'll give you an example of an unresonating ancient joke. An incompetent apprentice burst into tears when ordered by his master to manicure a gentleman's nails. When the client asked why, he said, "I'm frightened, I'm going to hurt you and you'll have sore fingers and my master will beat me." That either there's something that I haven't seen, or alternatively, of course, it is a very bad Roman joke. I mean, I think, you know, if you think of modern joke books, you know, they get rather less than a 75% hit rate. The Philagelos probably gets more. I think we have to reckon that some of these would have not resonated with Romans either. In general, though, they might not be side-splittingly funny, but as we've seen, we do see the joke in these. Between 1 and 2 millennia later, we're still finding them amusing. How plausible is that? And how could it be explained? Well, of course, it could be explained by some appeal to the complete universality of humour. Yeah, we all laugh at the same things, sex, death, all the rest. Now, I don't want to pour too much cold water on the notion of common traits in laughter, But I think that our amusement at the Philagelos may be a bit more complicated than it looks. For a start, just like everybody else, I've translated these ancient jokes from Greek into the standard tropes of contemporary joke making. Even using the word egghead instantly signals laughter. So do the rhythms, modalities, and cadences with which I've translated the exchanges and the punchline. So I've translated these as jokes to be funny. Secondly, like almost everybody else who's looked at this text, I've concentrated on the jokes that do most easily fit into our own style of laughter culture. Thirdly, there is a sense in which the superficial familiarity between ancient and modern joking can disguise the fact that we are, in fact, laughing at something quite different from our Roman predecessors. Now, some of you, and I hope you all can get something of a sight, but I'll describe it anyway. Some of you have got a cartoon from The New Yorker. What it is, for those who don't have an instant view of it, it's a cartoon of a man in a bar. The barman is pouring out a drink in the bar. The client, the customer, has got a pint in front of him. Obviously, his mobile phone, his cell phone, has just gone. He's holding his cell phone up to the mouth of the barman, and the barman's saying, "He's not here," right? Now, in some ways, and this was given to me by a student who'd heard me talk about the "he's not at home" Roman joke, came with this and said, "Look, it's the same joke," right? And in some ways, of course, it is. But the more you look at it, you see all sorts of ways in which what it's about isn't the same at all. If the Roman version is concerned with identity, the modern version seems not so much to be about that as about different ideas of presence and absence, which new technology problematizes. It's about availability, non-availability, and how that's disrupted by the invention of the mobile phone. I think it's a quite nice example of how we have to be careful about whether these things are really, whether we're really laughing at the same things. Nonetheless, there is a familiarity here which is not reducible to clever translation that we surely want to think harder about and to explain. It's not hard to see how some people have drawn a universalist conclusion from it. One of the biggest issues in laughter studies is how far laughter is a natural physiological response and how the prompts to it are themselves universal, part of the naturalness that laughter is. And research has extended from the cross-cultural efficacy of tickling to a number of famous theories, whether Freudian psychic relief or the perception of incongruity theory. It follows that anybody who backs any one of these universalising views of laughter tends to home in on the overlap between the jokes in the Philagelos and our jokes. One small example of the universality, human universality of the comic. Yet for me, that isn't a convincing way of explaining the similarity. This obviously is not the place to embark on the laughter, is it nature or culture debate. Nevertheless, the bottom line seems to be that whatever the universality of the phenomenon of laughter, and to some extent it is universal, it is also in practice something that we learn to do within our own cultures. We learn what to laugh at, in front of whom, and in what turn. Where do we learn it from? Well, immediately we learn it from our parents, teachers, and friends. You know, anybody who's had a child knows that you spend quite a lot of time saying, "Don't laugh," right? You know, they go and laugh at somebody with a wooden leg and you say, "Don't laugh." And you teach them to laugh at the Simpsons and not at the disabled. And it's quite a big part of parenting, is teaching your kids where and how to laugh. But I think also we learn what to laugh at from history. And it's also from the history of how laughter has been embedded unlearned within our own culture back into our own cultural roots. And my hunch really is this, to put it very simply. It is from the ancient Greco-Roman world that, since the Renaissance at least, we have learned quite a lot about what is funny, what can and cannot make us laugh. Of course, we haven't taken it over lock, stock and barrel. We don't laugh at exactly the same things. The Romans cracked up at the idea of people being blind. We don't. But nevertheless, the ancients have bequeathed to us the key coordinates which enables us to define what's funny and what's not. So when recently the comedian Jim Bowen did a whole stand-up show using nothing other than jokes from the Philagellos, I don't think it is necessarily as surprising as some newspapers found it that he got a good laugh. Because, in a way, these are the jokes that, through the Renaissance tradition and the rediscovery of classical antiquity, these are the jokes that have become and turned into our jokes, or at least they're the direct ancestors of them. To put it another way, when we make a tally of all those things that we've derived and adapted from antiquity, posh things like democracy, dictatorship, philosophy, pornography, I think that we've also got to add to that retinue the joke as a big, big inheritance of what we've got from the Greeks and Romans. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Mary. Stimulating as ever. We've got a little bit of time for questions. Anybody? Yes, over there to start.
A member of the audience said there's a Roman version of the famous Monty Python dead parrot joke.
Roman dead parrot joke. A man buys a slave from one of his fellow townsmen. Must be from an egghead. A man buys a slave from an egghead. And after a few weeks, the slave dies. So he goes back, the man goes back to the egghead to complain. Says, look, that slave died on me. Egghead says, well, that's funny, he never did that when I owned him.
Another question was whether there are many jokes about women.
Very, very few. There are. I didn't stress, you know, to preserve all our good humour, I did not stress the misogynist jokes in the Philagellos. There are plenty of, you know, glad to see you're burying the wife, you know, you have a peaceful time now kind of joke. There is one little mini collection in this encyclopedia, Macrobius's Saturnalia, kind of a mad late antique encyclopedia. There are some buried in chapters of that. There are sort of mini collections of jokes. And one of the sections, there's jokes of Cicero, jokes of the Emperor Augustus. And then there are jokes by and about Augustus's daughter Julia. And most of them are jokes made about her, like Augustus, a good baldy joke. Augustus knows that Julia is going grey and that Julia doesn't like going grey. So, like humanity everywhere, this is universal, she for some time pulls out the grey hairs in order not to appear to be going grey. Augustus is visiting the daughter one day and he spots her doing this and waits till the maids have gone, then goes in and says, hello, Julia. And the conversation turns to sort of, you know, philosophical things. He said, oh, Julia, would you prefer to be bald or grey? And she says, grey, of course, Daddy. And he says, well, why do you have your maids being so eager to make you bald then? Right. But there is a rather dirty joke that she makes. Because Julia's sex life is not as wholesome as her father would have wanted, as anybody who's read I, Claudius would know. And she has the habit she has is particularly having a particularly good time when she's pregnant, because then she can't get pregnant by anybody she shouldn't. She has a nasty little joke which says, I only take on passengers, new passengers, when the hold is full. Wouldn't want to meet her on a dark night, I think, Julia. God.
Two crucifixion jokes that come to mind. One is the schoolboy joke that pivots around the fact that after the resurrection, Jesus could no longer walk on water. The other one...
I had a sheltered upbringing.
The other one...
Nobody ever told me Christmas.
And I think we've all, in an odd way, sort of enjoyed this. The final scene of A Life of Brian, with the crucifixion choir singing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
Give my crucifixion joke. The Emperor Galba. We've all got them. And the interesting thing is that it's not clear that this is necessarily a joke, but it must be, I think. The Emperor Galba said he was going to crucify a very rich guy in Spain when he was governor of Spain. And the chap said, but I'm far too eminent to be crucified. Crucifixion is a low-class punishment. And said, I'm far too important for you to crucify. So... Galba said, well, in that case, I'll make the cross twice as high and paint it white.
You think that's a joke?
Well, yeah, it's, the interesting thing is that it's not signals as a joke in the source that does it. No. I think it is a joke, but there's an interesting debate to be had about that.
I have lived a sheltered life.
Okay. Anybody got a non-crucifixion joke?
There was one non-crucifixion joke based on a play on the Latin word quid.
The joke is, you need to know that quid in Latin means what. Two Romans going along, they see a coin on the ground. One says to the other, quid est. The other said, est quid.
One more I'm going to allow.
That's funnier than the Filagellos I have.
Yes, yes.
A member of the audience referred to the story of the man who felt ashamed because he felt well and hadn't seen his doctor for a long time. This is quite the opposite to what we're told of the Chinese, he said, who only pay their doctors when they are well. This seems a huge cultural difference.
Yes, it does. Yes, I'm afraid that the Greeks did not have that Chinese system. They only paid doctors. But I think that's kind of interesting because... I mean, one of the things I haven't talked about is in this kind of, you know, these vague claims about the universality of humour, actually, as soon as you get out of Western, you know, Anglo-Euro-American Australian first world humour, you know, we've all seen these television programmes which show you Japanese comedies, and we know that they are completely incomprehensible to us. So, actually, the Filagellos is understandable. Japanese comedy programmes... certainly in their kind of unmediated form before they've become kind of represented to us, are absolutely incomprehensible, as are, in my view, most 19th century issues of Punch.
Well, then.
Thank you.
Background Briefing today has been a public lecture by Cambridge Professor of Classics Mary Beard, delivered at Newcastle University in the UK recently. There'll be links to the university and to articles and other information about the Filagellos and Professor Beard on the Background Briefing website. I'm Kirsten Garrett. This is ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn.
Are you looking for a budget Christmas present that'll give hours of thought-provoking pleasure, maybe tears and laughter as well? Well, why not load up your loved one's MP3 player with Radio National podcasts? At Beachpod, you'll find a rich archive of podcasts like travel, music, food, and politics. There's something to suit everyone's taste at Beachpod. And you won't have to spend money on wrapping paper. Look for Beachpod on the Radio National homepage.